What we are now asked to worship, what had once been dressed as God or King, is the naked, twisted, mindless figure of the human incompetent. This is the new ideal, the goal to aim at, the purpose to live for. And all men are to be rewarded according to how close they approach it. This is the age of the common man, they tell us, a title which any man may claim to the extent of such distinction as he has managed not to achieve. He will rise to a rank of nobility by means of the effort he has failed to make. He will be honored for such virtue as he has not displayed, and he will be paid for the goods which he did not produce. But we who must atone for the guilt of ability, we will work to support him as he orders, with his pleasure as our only reward. Since we have the most to contribute, we will have the least to say. Since we have the better capacity to think, we will not be permitted a thought of our own. Since we have the judgment to act, we will not be permitted an action of our choice. We will work under directives and controls issued by those who are incapable of working. They will dispose of our energy, because they have none to offer, and of our product, because they can't produce. Do you say that this is impossible? That it cannot be made to work? They know it, but it is you who don't. And they are counting on you not to know it. They are counting on you to go on, to work to the limit of the inhuman, and to feed them while you last. And when you collapse, there will be another victim starting out and feeding them while struggling to survive. And the span of each succeeding victim will be shorter. And while you'll die to leave them a railroad, your last descendant in spirit will die to leave them a loaf of bread. This does not worry the looters of the moment. Their plan, like all the plans of all the royal looters of the past, is only that the loot shall last their lifetime. It has always lasted before, because in one generation they could not run out of victims. But this time, it will not last. The victims are on strike. We are on strike against martyrdom and against the moral code that demands it. We are on strike against those who believe that one man must exist for the sake of another. We are on strike against the morality of cannibals, be it practiced in body or in spirit. We will not deal with men on any terms but ours, and our terms are a moral code which holds that man is an end in himself and not the means to any end of others. We do not seek to force our code upon them. They are free to believe what they please, but for once they will have to believe it and to exist without our help. And once and for all, they will learn the meaning of their creed. That creed has lasted for centuries, solely by the sanction of the victims, by means of the victims' acceptance of punishment for breaking a code impossible to practice. But that code was intended to be broken. It is a code that thrives not on those who observe it, but on those who don't. A morality kept in existence not by virtue of its saints, but by the grace of its sinners. We have decided not to be sinners any longer. We have ceased breaking that moral code. We shall blast it out of existence forever by the one method that it can't withstand, by obeying it. We are obeying it. We are complying. In dealing with our fellow men, we are observing their code of values to the letter and sparing them all the evils they denounce. The mind is evil. We have withdrawn the works of our minds from society, and not a single idea of ours is to be known or used by men. Ability is a selfish evil that leaves no chance to those who are less able. We have withdrawn from the competition and left all chances open to incompetence. The pursuit of wealth is greed, the root of all evil. We do not seek to make fortunes any longer. It is evil to earn more than one's bare sustenance. We take nothing but the lowliest jobs, and we produce by the effort of our muscles no more than we consume for our immediate needs, and not a penny, nor an inventive thought left over to harm the world. It is evil to succeed, since success is made by the strong at the expense of the weak. We have ceased burdening the weak with our ambition, and have left them free to prosper without us. It is evil to be an employer. We have no employment to offer. It is evil to own property. We own nothing. It is evil to enjoy one's existence in this world. There is no form of enjoyment that we seek from their world. And this was hardest for us to attain. What we now feel for their world is that emotion which they preach as an ideal. Indifference, the blank, the zero, the mark of death. We are giving men everything they've professed to want and to seek as virtue for centuries. Now let them see whether they want it.
It was you who started this strike? She asked.
I did.
He got up. He stood, hands in pockets, his face in the light. And she saw him smile with the easy, effortless, implacable amusement of certainty.
We've heard so much about strikes, he said, and about the dependence of the uncommon man upon the common. We've heard it shouted that the industrialist is a parasite, that his workers support him, create his wealth, make his luxury possible. And what would happen to him if they walked out? Very well, I propose to show to the world who depends on whom, who supports whom, who is the source of wealth. Who makes whose livelihood possible? And what happens to whom when who walks out? The windows were now sheets of darkness, reflecting the dots of lighted cigarettes. He picked a cigarette from a table beside him, and in the flare of a match, she saw the brief sparkle of gold, the dollar sign between his fingers. I quit and joined him and went on strike, said Hugh Axton. Because I could not share my profession with men who claim that the qualification of an intellectual consists of denying the existence of the intellect. People would not employ a plumber who'd attempt to prove his professional excellence by asserting that there's no such thing as plumbing, but apparently the same standards of caution are not considered necessary in regard to philosophers. I learned from my own pupil, however, that it was I who made this possible. When thinkers accept those who deny the existence of thinking, as fellow thinkers of a different school of thought, it is they who achieve the destruction of the mind. They grant the enemy's basic premise, thus granting the sanction of reason to formal dementia. A basic premise is an absolute that permits no cooperation with its antithesis and tolerates no tolerance. In the same manner, and for the same reason, as a banker may not accept and pass counterfeit money, granting it the sanction, honor, and prestige of his bank, just as he may not grant the counterfeiter's demand for tolerance of a mere difference of opinion, so I may not grant the title of philosopher to Dr. Simon Pritchett, or compete with him for the minds of men. Dr. Pritchett has nothing to deposit to the account of philosophy, except his declared intention to destroy it. He seeks to cash in, by means of denying it, on the power of reason among men. He seeks to stamp the mint mark of reason upon the plans of his looting masters. He seeks to use the prestige of philosophy to purchase the enslavement of thought. But that prestige is an account which can exist only so long as I am there to sign the checks. Let him do it without me. Let him and those who entrust to him their children's minds have exactly that which they demand, a world of intellectuals without intellect and of thinkers who proclaim that they cannot think. I am conceding it. I am complying. And when they see the absolute reality of their non-absolute world, I will not be there, and it will not be I who will pay the price of their contradiction.
Dr. Axton quit on the principle of sound banking, said Midas Mulligan. I quit on the principle of love. Love is the ultimate form of recognition one grants to superlative values. It was the Hunsacker case that made me quit, that case when a court of law ordered that I honor as first right to my depositors' funds the demand of those who would offer proof that they had no right to demand it. I was ordered to hand out money earned by men to a worthless rotter whose only claim consisted of his inability to earn it. I was born on a farm. I knew the meaning of money. I dealt with many men in my life. I'd watched them grow. I'd made my fortune by being able to spot a certain kind of man, the kind who never asked you for faith, hope, and charity, but offered you facts, proof, and profit. Did you know that I invested in Hank Reardon's business at the time when he was rising? When he had just beaten his way out of Minnesota to buy the steel mills in Pennsylvania? Well, when I looked at that court order on my desk, I had a vision. I saw a picture, and I saw it so clearly that it changed the looks of everything for me. I saw the bright face and the eyes of young Reardon, as he'd been when I'd met him first. I saw him lying at the foot of an altar with his blood running down into the earth. And what stood on that altar was Lee Hunsacker, with the mucus-filled eyes whining that he'd never had a chance. It's strange how simple things become once you see them clearly. It wasn't hard for me to close that bank and go. I kept seeing for the first time in my life what it was that I'd lived for and loved.
She looked at Judge Narragansett. You quit over the same case, didn't you?
Yes, said Judge Narragansett. I quit when the Court of Appeals reversed my ruling. The purpose for which I'd chosen my work was my resolve to be a guardian of justice. But the laws they asked me to enforce made me the executor of the vilest injustice conceivable.
I was asked to use force to violate the rights of disarmed men who came before me to seek my protection for their rights. Litigants obey the verdict of a tribunal solely on the premise that there is an objective rule of conduct which they both accept. Now I saw that one man was to be bound by it, but the other was not. One was to obey a rule, the other was to assert an arbitrary wish, his need. And the law was to stand on the side of the wish. Justice was to consist of upholding the unjustifiable. I quit, because I could not have borne to hear the words Your Honor addressed to me by an honest man.